Hello, this is Matt Hale with Resonance 104.4, and we're doing the Art Monthly program. Today we're discussing some texts which are in the current issue, April issue 345, 2011, that is. And I'm joined today by a person who's not been on with us before, which is great to always have a new guest, Morgan Quaintance, who's a writer, musician and curator. Hello, Morgan.
Hello.
And also by a writer who's been on the programme before, Peter Suchin, a writer and critic and artist, which I think is a very important aspect of Peter,
so particularly,
as he is writing about artists today. Now, he's written a feature which is entitled Rebel Without a Course, that's C-O-U-R-S-E, which is a great title, I reckon. And Morgan has written a review on general ideas, exhibition, I think called Haute Culture. Am
yeah,
I right?
That's right, that's right.
Now, I've been to that place. It's called Musée d'Art de la Ville de Paris.
Yeah.
I thought it was called the Ville de la Cité de Paris.
But
we've missed the city out, or they have, I don't know. But anyway, it's a good building. I've been there. Morgan, tell us, you went to Paris and saw the show. What did you think?
Yeah, I went to Paris and saw the show, and it was kind of another great blockbuster for this institution, because previously to this exhibition they had probably the biggest Jean-Michel Basquiat retrospective,
yep,
which was really impressive if exhausting. So this time around I went to see the General Idea show, and what was really exciting about seeing all of their works gather together, because what it did is it spanned their career from, 1967 to 1994,
yeah,
the year two of its members, Felix Parts and Jorge Zontel, died of the AIDS virus.
Yep.
But what was really interesting about it was the way they sort of reframed this art, this group's practice. Traditionally, or kind of dismissively, people have referred to them as kind of being the AIDS group, or the artists who are best known for this sort of doing work to do with the AIDS epidemic, the AIDS virus.
Sort of simplification of their practice.
Yeah,
really.
And also kind of tying them in with things to do with queer aesthetics and a kind of 1980s significance. So it's almost like a way of dismissing them and saying, oh, they're all about AIDS, they're all about the 80s, and they're all about queerness.
Yeah.
And what was really interesting to me was that it wasn't just about that. It was actually to do with this kind of fictional narrative that they constructed, which kind of fueled the generation of their artworks, which was really similar to Matthew Barney's Cream Master Cycle and
yep,
stuff like artists like Charles Avery are kind of trying to do at the moment, and also back to Alistair Gray, you know, who made Lanark, which is this kind of this crazy
That's
narrative.
A novel, wasn't it?
The novel
read,
Lanark, yeah,
yeah. Scottish writer,
novel,
Glaswegian.
Yeah,
yeah,
so it's kind
book.
Of
I've read that.
What was interesting is that you got to see how they sort of fell into this narrative as a mechanism for generating artworks. So initially that you see kind of their flirtation with conceptual and male art, and it's a kind of wry take on both of those disciplines.
How do you spell male there? M-A-I-L?
M-A-I-L, yeah. Like sending things to each other. But so initially you get this kind of, you know, it's almost if they have to do this. If you're a young artist, postgraduate, working around the late 60s, early 70s, what do you do? It's conceptual art or male art. But the way they kind of used that form was quite interesting, quite funny, quite wry. And then they kind of developed this fictional idea out of this thing called the Miss General Idea pageant.
So that's Miss as in M-I-S-S.
Miss,
sorry to keep doing this, but it's just...
Yeah.
It's radio,
yeah. Yeah, because it's radio, yeah. But basically, it's a non-gender-specific beauty pageant that happens every year from 1970 until 1984. Now, what happened within this pageant was that each year somebody would win, but at the conception of the pageant in 1970, the group, which also featured an artist called A.A. Bronson.
Yes, who's still alive and in New York.
Yeah,
and
still,
he's
still
been
working
in contact with Art Monthly.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so this initial pageant happened in 1917, was set to finish in 1984, and along the way, in line with this pageant, they constructed this fictional building called the Miss General Idea Pavilion, which, if you could imagine, I don't know, another pavilion at the Venice Biennale, which is kind of large, sort of quasi-museological space. But it was kind of a part, I called it in the article, part Dionysian Sanctum, part bathhouse, because it kind of looked like a kind of Grecian bacchanalian space, but also with lots of like naked male flesh and buttocks everywhere. So that was quite interesting, but...
You don't mean real ones?
No, I don't mean real ones. I mean... Well,
you might do. I don't, that's what I meant.
Is this a reconstructed thing? Yeah, this is a reconstructed. But basically, what happened was by 1984, they decided to destroy this fictional pavilion that didn't exist. So all of their artworks, that a lot of their artworks were kind of notionally pulled from this fictional rubble. So you'd have like gates and doors with different emblems of these sort of.
I see.
Yeah, so that's
basically a fiction about a fiction, then, isn't it?
Yeah, but
one's physically in existence and one wasn't.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Sorry, that I'm getting there.
So it's almost like what's interesting is that, you know, like Matthew Barney's Cream Master Cycle, when you go to the exhibitions, you see these artifacts from these fictional constructs or fictional universes, which are the five Cream Master films. So for me, the Miss General Idea pageant and the Miss General Idea pavilion functioned in the same way, although I don't think they got to realise it in the kind of cinematic form, which is, I think, undoubtedly where they would have gone towards had they kept going.
Just thinking about the Matthew Barney thing, they're almost, well, kind of props from the films, aren't they? Really? Which you could
get if you saw his sculptures
Well, presumably there were some of the things are actually used as opposed to their fictions that are backing up. And perhaps I don't know if he sells those things, you know, as artworks or.
And they presumably sell some of these, I imagine.
Yeah, I think. Well, General Idea is all about additions. So most of the things that you see are available to buy as multiples.
Yeah.
And this is another thing that's quite interesting about General Idea, which I have some trouble with in a way, is that what they do is seems to be kind of so close in a way to kind of marketing. Like they're kind of really gifted admin almost. Like the way they embrace.
You said this in a review, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. The way they embrace these different forms, it's so. Kind of it kind of gets inside your mind like a kind of meme, you know, the different images that they're using. But in a way, sometimes you think, I don't know if what I'm looking at is art necessarily, or if it's like a really interesting campaign for something that doesn't exist. Like they have a piece called Nazi Milk, which is a kind of detour in a way of a campaign that the Americans that used to run in America to help sort of propagate the drinking of milk by children because it's supposed to strengthen your bones. And what they did was A.A. Bronson was featured in this kind of mock advert where he'd be dressed as like a Hitler youth, and the milk moustache that was left was the kind of Hitler, you know, moustache. So instantly creating this recognisable image that was kind of really interesting.
But these commercial techniques which that you're saying, I mean, they are mimicking real ones in society, that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
So when they adopted, I mean, they were adopting the methods of, in order to get across their own.
But it's weird because they come out of that sort of time, I suppose, with Andy Warhol and maybe even John Waters, where there is a love for the media. You know, it's not necessarily an aggression towards the media or a way to subvert it or a kind of situationist.
Well, I think you call it a passive gesture here.
Well,
I think
I think some people have accused.
Okay.
That we're talking. That was in reference to Image Virus, which was a large project which ran from 1987 to 1993, which was another system that they constructed which generated artworks. Basically, what the Image Virus project was, General Idea reappropriated a image by Robert Indiana, which is the love image. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's like a multicoloured square.
Yeah, it's very famous.
Yeah, broken into four segments.
Moment of the 60s or something, isn't it?
Yeah. They replaced L-O-V-E with A-I-D-S.
Yeah.
And sort of this image appeared in different places across cities in the world. And so what they found with this new system was that they could do whatever they wanted with it. So outside the museum in Paris, there's a large three-dimensional sculpture of the AIDS thing where people have done graffiti on it. There's wallpaper versions of it. It's in Times Square on the kind of LCD display. They've also reappropriated other people's works in making this reappropriation again.
Oh.
And they did a thing called AIDS Nauman, which is the taped corridor piece that Nauman did.
Right,
where you sort of walk down, you see yourself walking down.
Oh, I know the videotape. You mean where you see yourself appearing at the end of a you walk around a corner. Was it the Haywood?
I
walked down it. Yes.
So their hall called AIDS Nauman is the hallway, but wallpapered with this AIDS image.
Yeah.
So it was another system that they could use to just sort of attach to anything.
Well, they were infiltrating the culture. Would you say?
Yeah.
I mean, was that their intention? I mean,
I think so. I think that's why they called it Image Virus, and they sort of saw it as a kind of viral. a manifestation of this idea. And I think that was really key, even though it is a little bit exhausting because it always emerges, and even in the article, that's the image that was used to illustrate it, even though I kind of wanted it to move away from that. But it's kind of, you can't really, it's a valiant gesture anyway, because we need to be aware of the age.
Well, we still need to be reminded now.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it hasn't gone away, has it?
Yeah.
No, but I know what you mean. I remember seeing that a lot from the 80s onwards, and after a while you almost became immune to that. Because the trouble is that because it does use the same sort of system as a Barclays logo or whatever, that repetition of the same thing in the particular design, you do become, well, you feel immune. You feel as if you're not seeing it, really. You're over familiar, therefore you don't even notice it.
I thought it was interesting what Morgan said about the the matter of general idea, not really, seemingly, I don't know, you might disagree, but not challenging the kind of market, or not challenging, fitting into it, not really trying to subvert things. So, it's quite interesting to wonder.
But as an effective method, do we feel?
Well, I think the fact that they can use this graphics, and they're very savvy at doing that. That's kind of, I mean, in a way, you could say, well, why don't they fill those images with a different content, or generate a discourse around advertising that's anti-advertising, paradoxically.
I think,
as opposed to just make an art career out of it.
Yeah. But I think
maybe that's asking too much.
One of the things that's interesting about that is that they were sufferers of this virus itself.
Yeah.
And I think in doing it this way, it does work just as well as if they were being quite confrontational and sort of attacking the language of advertising, as well as raising awareness. Because I think just to get this image out there was a big deal.
Well, it wasn't going to happen if they didn't do it.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
And they're nothing like the same, probably, amount. Mm. Certainly not in the art world. So.
And I think the year that they put it in Times Square on the big LCD display was the same year that Mark Kostabi, as a kind of quite low-grade artist, made these really astonishing homophobic comments in Vanity Fair. Sort of saying that
knowing him just to get attention.
Saying that all curators should die because they're homosexual anyway. And it's kind of, you kind of forget how important it is just to do this and have it out there. But I do think it's important to think about other things that related to general ideas practice, which, again, to bring it back to this exploration of a fictional narrative generating the production of artworks.
Which would we use the word research? Vaguely in relation to that method,
because it was quite interesting thinking about Peter's article and this idea of research and what artists are doing, and in a way it's almost as if a general idea aren't necessarily reaching into textbooks to do this massive amount of academic research, but they're kind of generating their own body of knowledge that they're pulling from.
Yes, which is a form of research.
Which is what artists do, which is one of the things
I think that is a very appropriate time to begin to talk about Peter's feature as well. Because, Peter, you do... Basically, you're talking about the PhD and art education, obviously, connected out of that, aren't you? And in that research, you mentioned research a number of times. I mean, let's try and... Can we, Morgan, move across and Peter, begin your piece. I mean, there are lots of questions in it, and you could always pick. I could almost pick one at random. But
research a little bit.
Yeah, begin the research area.
What the piece does first of all, it started off really as I tried to write a piece about how artists validate themselves or try to validate themselves as practicing artists with the public and with the audiences in the gallery and how they try and do that. And then as part of that, I wanted to write about the PhD, because I think now lots of artists are signing up to do so-called practice-based PhDs. And I feel that doesn't really validate anything, except the institution that they're selling you the PhD.
Right, which is a fairly strong opinion. Very interesting.
In the article, what I do, I try and kind of argue the problems around PhDs, right? So I quote John Thompson, who in a paper from, I think it was the late 90s, said, he didn't understand why artists needed these things anyway, right? Except maybe to get a job, why you need a PhD. And the point to make really is that one isn't anti-research, because all artists have to do research.
As we were just describing with Morgan and general idea.
But I also quote Michael Baldwin, who's one of the two long-standing members of the Art and Language Group. And they've been around for about 30 years or maybe more. And also Charles Harrison, who died, I think, last year, who was the kind of writer who worked with him, an art historian. And Charles Harrison, the quote from him I use, the quotation is that he says, well, we did our research, you know, and we had a journal called Art Language. And the important thing about it is it was completely under our control. It wasn't determined by a manager in the university what counted as research or by government funding. We just did it. You know, we printed this thing and we distributed it. And that, for me, is a good model of the autonomy of the artist. Right? And the trouble with the PhD thing is, I think, if you sign up to do a PhD, I think a lot of artists, I mean, a lot of artists I've talked to, what they seem to think is going to happen is they can go into an institution, they may get some funding, or they may not, from the institution, or they may have to find a lot of funding themselves. But they go into the institution, they have access to libraries, workshops, other students and other PhD candidates, and of course academics and intellectuals and staff. And they talk like this, it's like, I'm going to do it, but I don't really believe in that system myself, but I want to do this thing to keep my practice going. Now, I feel that's completely wrong-headed, because the institution, by being an institution, changes the practice. It has a bearing on what the practice is. And for example, some of the people I know, what they have to do, they have to make a proposal, say a 1,000-word long proposal, what their practice is about. They have to come up with a research question, which is a kind of scientific approach to it. And then they get the bit of paper sent back to them by the lecturer, and they say, look, you haven't really turned this question into the right kind of question, so do it again. So the practice gets modelled, or, you know, the art practice, in as far as it's separate from writing, gets modelled or remodelled to fit what will get you a PhD.
Right.
That's one problem with it.
Whereas what you're saying is, if you are, say, your general idea, your art and language, and you are, although, say, discussing something between three people, like, or more, if in art and language's case at some point,
yeah,
you're getting bouncing ideas off other artists and people who you know.
Yeah, and you're reading all sorts of stuff.
You're independent in what you do with that information, and how you could create it into art or use it to make art. But whereas in university, you think that, particularly with academic... I mean, the art school became academic. Patricia Biffin said on one of our programmes a couple of months ago that, you know, when the art schools became part of the polytechnics, I think it was, she said, possibly even before that, that's when it was like, that's when the academicisation of the art. I mean, John Thompson thinks, you know, that, say, the judgment should be made of a PhD student by Viva, by a group of artists.
I don't necessarily think that makes much sense, really. I think because the role of the artist and what an artist does and accomplishes has changed quite significantly. I'm not really that clued up on what happened around the time when it changed into, you know, people, this amalgamation of what institutions were before with polytechnics.
Yeah.
But certainly now, what artists may be looking to sort of broaden their knowledge field isn't necessarily just to do with esoteric academic texts or philosophical texts. It's not Deleuze and Guattari. I mean, specifically, say if you're a new media artist, I mean, there's a significant amount of scientific research that you may have to do in order to get to a certain level in your practice. And this is one of the things that really surprised me when I was doing my undergraduate, which was in sonic arts. And we'd have discussions with people doing photography and hear about their crits where they were really being destroyed on a kind of foundation that had no real concrete basis in anything except for subjectivity. And I always found that really interesting.
Mm. So not on the technical side.
But we'd have crits and it'd be like somebody would be working on an algorithm to sort of regulate pitch shifting. And there's a way you can test whether or not that works or doesn't work.
You could do that with painting or something as well, to a degree, but...
What you mean? You could criticise. I mean,
there's always a technical aspect, isn't there? Mm. If you are a conceptual artist and you're just writing, well, if you're not very good at writing, or if you can't spell, or it's a technical thing that it might matter in the work.
But would that be fair criticism to criticise that? Because what Morgan was saying was that they were not being criticised for that. Mm. More, they were being criticised for the subjective, subjectively being criticised by people on their subjectivity. Yeah. Is that what you mean?
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's just. This quote by, I think, Harrison, it says, in science, you can generally at least tell what is and what is not research. In the art, certainly. In the practice of art, you cannot. And I don't see how that applies to new media or sonic arts.
Yeah, well, it doesn't, does it? That's the problem, really.
I mean,
I'm not against, and I don't think any of the people I'm quoting, like, I mean, John Thompson, famous, you know, respected art teacher, art lecturer, art and language, you know, Harrison, they're all into knowledge and language, and, you know, they're not anti-intellectuals, quite the opposite. But I think what they're kind of saying, and as far as they're, I mean, I'm using quotations from them, to build up an argument about the practice based about the PhD. They're not always talking exactly about that. But what they're doing is saying artists don't really work like scientists, you know, like the quotation you just read out. They don't work like that. And therefore, I mean, if a PhD is going to be serious, it has to be rigorous and across the board, right? So if you get a PhD in one university, it should be broadly, you know, equivalent to one somewhere else. And first of all, that's not happening at all, right? Because some people write 5,000 words and they still call themselves, get called doctor at the end of it all if they pass it on. And somebody else writes 60 or 80,000 words. So first of all, there's no unification about this thing that's being awarded.
Right.
And then secondly, artists that do research, but do they have to, I mean, if the research doesn't map onto a scientific model and onto a kind of historical model, what a PhD was, then how can it, why should we even call it a PhD, you know? So I'm not against people reading, you know, getting together, even in institutions and doing this. But if the institution starts saying, right, this has got to be rigorous or it won't be validated, so you've now got to do this, this and this in your practice, who's calling the shots for the artist? And I suppose I do have a bit of a kind of romantic idea of the artist is antagonistic to institutions, which kind of came up before, you know, and that's why I was asking about general idea and, like, you know, is it just a career move to, like, do clever graphics, or is it a subversion because they're not happy with the world they're in? And presumably it's more the latter with them, you know, with the,
I assumed they were using those forms because that was the way to get something which was being suppressed or not acknowledged or needed to be more so and was part of their own lives. I mean, it was their own dealing with their own personal history, weren't they? And using them to get them out there.
But it's quite interesting because I don't really understand what this definition of scientific research is. It's used quite a lot in the article, but it's never really qualified. Yeah, well, what does that mean, scientific research?
Do you think there's a division being risen that isn't really, like, there isn't such as you said, digital media in the middle is somewhere between science and can be used subjectively or by an artist, or it can be used for something quite technical and scientific.
There's partly that, but I think the thing about a scientific model is that it's testable, right? So you train as a scientist, you learn certain techniques and you learn certain experiments, and you know, and then you may, as an innovator in science, come up with something new, right? And then that's tested by other scientists. So it's more objective than subjective, whereas in the art thing we're talking about, the art sphere, it's much more about each person inventing, in the ideology, I don't believe it necessarily, but, you know, doing your own thing as an artist, inventing your own language, which I think is nonsense, but that's what people say to
you. Well, you say it's a nonsense, so therefore it's actually...
Because language is public and social.
No, I'm not saying you're wrong to say it's a nonsense, but if it is a nonsense, then doesn't that make it mean that it is quantifiable? Because, I mean, maybe has the art world changed to the point where actually now it is more... who is a good artist or a bad artist, right, or whether
I think we should get away from this idea that it's people doing PhDs are painters and it's like they're going to be sitting in darkened rooms.
They're doing all sorts of things, aren't they?
Exactly.
Know? So well, a huge variety, I imagine.
Yeah, and I mean, it is quantifiable. What I'm trying to say is that for people working today, especially in new media, it is quantifiable and it is exactly close to a scientific model. For instance, if Nam June Paik was doing a PhD today, he'd be contributing significant knowledge to the practice of new media by inventing these different synthesis models and ways of using television.
But you could still criticise him on whether or not... Well, one would imagine that it's possible to think he's a good or bad artist, or whether the art side... media in this case, you know, if it doesn't matter how much he's contributing to that, to the scientific side of new media, or, you know, any kind of new form that an artist decides to link with and use and develop, does it make them a better artist? I mean,
I didn't know.
It doesn't to me.
Yeah, is it about whether or not they're a good artist or whether or not the PhD is legitimate? Because I thought it was
understanding what a PhD is for, then.
Right, yeah.
Peter, you go first.
Well, what I wanted to say about it was that, I mean, I'm not against, as I've already said, I'm not against people studying. I mean, obviously I'm not, right? And I quote Victor Bergen in this.
I was going to bring him up, yeah.
Which is a good little set of points he makes from a book, a short article he has in a book called Artists with PhDs, edited by James Elkins, came out, I think, last year. And he gives three different, you know, models or three different ideas of types of student.
Suited to doing PhDs.
That would be, and I can't quite remember now. One of them is... you know, an artist who someone whose background is a lot of, has done a lot of writing and theory, but want to work in an environment with artists. You know, his reasons are good, right? I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's what a lot of the practice-based PhDs do. I mean, most of the people I know have done practice, the ones I talk to and ask them questions, they're miserable, they have no money, they said, we're kind of told they'd get a grant, but they didn't, like, you know, none of them did. Mm. And they hate the other, sometimes seem to hate the other candidates. So, why she keeps talking in the seminar? So I say to the friends, well, why do you go back to college at 40, you know? Mm. Now, I'm not against going, I think that the whole thing is a kind of red herring, that it validates, I mean, now to maybe get a teaching job or more and more, you need to get this, you know, PhD, because then you've got, you're higher up the, you know, food chain or whatever. But then when everybody gets PhDs, what's going to be that? What's going to happen next? Is everybody going to do another one, you know? It's kind of a crazy thing. And it's about validating the institutions on existence to keep those people in jobs. And I'm not against, you know, I'm not for people losing jobs, but it isn't really what it says. That's what I feel. And I don't think anybody really knows quite what it is either.
Well, that may be the case.
Including me, you know.
I mean, I think I agree with you on that score, and in terms of, there seems to be quite a few things going on. There's the idea that qualifications are just used as a smokescreen for institutions to get more revenue so that they can function, and that people can use them to get jobs when actually they're quite meaningless. But parallel to that, I think there is a legitimate cause for PhDs, for people who are doing rigorous research and practice and who are capable of writing long dissertations.
Yeah.
So it would be quite interesting to know, like, especially what the people who are dissatisfied with those PhDs, what their practices were. Did they have a clear vision of what they're going to
were
achieve?
Were they in the wrong place? Really?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Because well, they may just be people who actually shouldn't be doing them.
Some practices, whereas a lot of might. Some practices just don't fit into.
Yeah, which is what Victor Bergen's suggesting, right? I'd say, right. By having
they're
3
just
point. Yeah.
And, I've talked to artists and go, well, I do this, and this. Why can't I get a PhD for it? I deserve it. And it's this sort of self-promoting kind of model of the artist who thinks that anything they do is okay. And then the institution should validate them because they think them sort of serious. Then they go into the institution, and the institution goes, no, we can't count that as an example of PhD-type research because there are some criteria with external examiners and other people coming in. You know, you can't just put anything forward, is it? So it's either rigorous or it's not, and then whether the artist's work fits, that is a problem. But I'd like to talk, actually, just jump back to, you just mentioned the word smoke, it said smokescreen.
Yeah.
Well, I started my article with a reference to an exhibition that's just finished a couple of days ago in a gallery called the Apiary Gallery in London, in East London. And what I really was writing about at the beginning of my piece was a press release for a show. The show was called The Emaciated Spectator, and I can't pronounce the group's name. They made it up deliberately to be difficult to pronounce. It's something like psychoanalyze, okay? Mm. But when you saw the gallery, when you saw the show, it was various objects, neon lights, different things, photographs, in a room full of smoke, right? And then the press release had a little bit of it where it had four, I think it was, tick boxes, and then the headings were smoke-filled room, tick, Jacques Rancière reference, tick, and a couple of other things. And I thought they were kind of very interesting what they did. I mean, I don't think the show is that great, personally, but I thought the way that they were going, right, we're out in the world as artists. We're not doing a PhD. We're not getting someone to validate us. We have to create, in a sense, our own importance, if that makes sense. So what we're doing is we'll make a reference to the fashionable world of smoke-filled rooms, light boxes or whatever, you know, we're going to comment on that in the show. And I mean, I went to a discussion about this that came up yesterday, a discussion about this big group of students and people who'd been were still at Goldsmiths or they'd left recently. And they were saying, no, we don't think it's good art. We all know it's a con. We all know it's about marketing. But I like the way that this group just said, okay, this is the current fashion as we see it. So we'll give it to you on a plate and see what happens.
Now, sounds a bit like general
idea. It's very like general idea.
Well, no, I don't think it's like general idea, because I think this is basically what is wrong with institutions, especially Goldsmiths, where there's a lot of idea heavy, or there's a lot of conceptual stuff flying around, and people come out and do things like this, and it speaks to a very small public.
Sure.
And a public that's already aware of the gag, they're already in on the joke. And so it's kind of like a useless gesture. And what all it does is kind of reinforce ideas that I'm quite clever, and so are you, because you understand it.
Or don't.
Maybe also useless gesture. guess, you know, maybe that's the meaning of this happening.
Yeah, but I don't necessarily think it is. In a way, that's kind of, it's quite defeatist position to take, really. And I think it raises other questions that part of what I kind of agreed with you about PhDs is this kind of wider concern of actually, can you teach art? Is it possible to teach art? And why are people looking to university? Why are people looking to text to validate what they're doing?
One reason why universities, for some PhD people, might be brilliant is that they couldn't afford all the equipment they get access to.
So those
are only reasons I can completely understand. Practical reasons, I get it.
Yeah.
Maybe this is where Peter, go.
All right. No, all I wanted to say about it really was that I feel there's a kind of disingenuous thing going on when people do PhDs often. And it's partly because their practice is stuck, so they want to kind of stir things up. Well, it's not terrible to do that. But, I mean, if you go into university and then you get a PhD and then you come out, you know, are you a better artist for it? Or are you just someone who's like all the other ones who've got the PhDs? I think a lot of people who do practice, well, I'm guessing, you know, but my feeling is that people who do PhDs, quite often they're people who haven't got on in the art world, so they'll get the validation, the pat on the back, and the certificate, which will give them a status in the world they're in of other people doing that. So it's not really, I mean, it goes away from art in a sense. It's about, I mean, it ties up somehow with careers, doesn't it? That people who, I mean, I can't think of any famous artists with PhDs, isn't it?
I'm sure they exist, but I'm sure there's plenty out there who haven't.
There's a kind of subtext going on of people who are not getting on in their practice. Or they might be, you know, I don't know if this is true. I'm kind of guessing and trying to work things out from conversations with friends who are doing these things, you know, but I just feel that a lot of the time, the answer is not the institution, is it? I mean, I still have this kind of romantic idea about the artist, if you like, that the artist is out there on their own, you know, and you have to, that's why I keep quoting Art and Language, because in the 60s and 70s, they invented a space for themselves as artists.
We've got 1 minute left, guys.
I just like to say, I think you're right to a degree, but I think separate to that, there is a kind of legitimate line of people pursuing PhDs for legitimate reasons which are research-based. Are quantifiably, you can analyse them quantifiably, and I think, they need to, they exist side by side, really. You can't sort of dismiss one by sort of saying the other one is the dominant force.
Okay, that's got to be the end. We'd hope that you enjoy the conversation. There's lots more to say. We'll probably carry on in a second. The programme's only half an hour long. You've been listening to Art Monthly on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thank you ever so much to Peter Suchin. And thank you to Morgan Quaintance as well.